So, today is our final delve into Philippians, which we began in January. So, I'll just quickly talk about some of the things we've looked at in Philippians. We've looked at Paul as a prisoner who really knows suffering and yet finds his grounding in Christ, not in the trials that he's enduring. We've talked about Paul as a prayerful, faithful follower of Jesus who loves the Philippians and who wishes for them to cease their anxieties both about Paul and about their own difficult circumstances. Both Paul and the Philippians are having trials. And he's encouraged them to let their suffering be a space where they can model following Jesus. We've had encouragement to find an identity grounded in the upside-down trajectory of Jesus, whose humility has restored relationship between God and humanity, and whose divine human mind is at work in the Philippian community. And that work of the divine human mind is to create unity, humility, and selflessness. We've talked about Christ as the measure of what matters to God, that Christ became a nobody to live out God's love for people. We've had an emphasis on the unified community thinking, being unified in the mind of Christ, allowing Jesus to shape a mental paradigm for living. We've had in there a very firm reminder not to grumble about each other, not because that's incidental, but that is core to our witness to God, to Christ's love. And we've had Paul and Epaphroditus and Timothy held up as examples of how you might put this into practice, how you might live serving Christ selflessly. Then we've had a consideration of how Philippian status markers and false self might inhibit their ability to live in this way that Paul's outlined, and a reminder that Christian unity is the marker by which the world around will recognise Christ and come to love him, which is very core for Paul, that the world will come to love Christ. So that brings us to our concluding chapter. And it begins with joy, which is a recurrent theme right through Philippians, and especially in this chapter 4, where Paul is expressing joy over and over. Paul's joy and Paul's love for the Philippians start and frame what comes. If you're a limited listener today, have a think as we head forward. The next section is about, I've got to read their names right, Euodia and Syntyche, who seem to be in conflict. Who are you in conflict or tension with today, particularly if it's someone in this community? How might you apply the mind of Christ to the conflicts, the tension that you are currently in? That's your question if you don't want to listen to me talking. It'll be easier to listen to me talking. So, Euodia and Syntyche. There's some dispute about this. Some people think the whole reason Paul wrote this letter to the Philippians was to address these two women. Many other people think the letter is about encouraging the Philippians in their struggles, and this is an example of that rather than the main point. We know that women were prominent in the culture of Macedonia, where Philippi is. They held prominent roles, they ran businesses. They were not the oppressed women of the patriarchy that we particularly find in Palestine in the Jesus stories. And particularly in the Philippian church, it was founded by women. Lydia was the contact point when Paul came to Philippi. And Paul notes that these two women, whose names I have trouble saying, I'll say them lots of times until I get them right, Euodia and Syntyche, that they were fellow workers with him in the gospel. They worked really hard. Paul doesn't seem to be concerned with the content of their dispute. He doesn't seem to worry about who's right and wrong, but he's very interested in the impact of this division on the community that he loves. We've already had unity over and over as the key marker of Christian community. So it's a major issue if someone in the church he's writing to is not demonstrating unity, and particularly if that's the leaders of that church. So how is he to tactfully address this? How might you tactfully address that if you were in that situation? First, he publicly names the tension and identifies that this is a problem. And then he speaks well of the individuals involved. He praises their gospel work. He notes that their names are written in the Book of Life. And he identifies them as fellow workers in Christ. And he identifies them as friends. In Greco-Roman culture, it was customary if you were talking about your friends, that you would name them. But if you were talking about your enemies, you would not name them, and that was part of the culture of how you showed that they were your enemies, was by giving them the silent treatment, not dignifying them by using their name. So to name them says, these women are my friends. Paul is very brief, I think that's on purpose, and he doesn't take sides. He addresses each of them equally. The wording is exactly the same for both of them. And he addresses them directly. And he calls on the whole community to support them in reconciliation. How easy it is when there's a dispute between two people in the community for us to take sides and to fall in and to make it bigger. And once that happens, the people who have fallen into one side or the other can become more invested in the dispute than the original people who were having the dispute. But then it's very hard for them to back out because they've got a following. Paul is really specifically saying, don't do that. Your role as the community when there's a dispute is to support those people in their reconciliation. And the whole thing is framed in this beautiful letter about unity in the community. The whole community is called to unity. He's not singling these women out. He's saying this is what everyone needs to be doing, not just these two. They are called to come to agreement, and the Greek word is phronein, to be of one mind. It's this word that is used over and over through Philippians. And we already know from chapter 2 that the one mind is not just any old agreement. The one mind is to share the mind of Christ, the mind of humility, emptying of self, service and love. So Paul is not saying, tell those bickering women to get over it so we can get on with the important stuff. And to the shame of our patriarchal church, many commentators have preached on this in that way. But Paul is saying that unity is the important stuff. He's not saying tell them, he's saying help them. And he's not saying get over it. He's saying come together into a Christ-like attitude to your dispute. I think that's why he's not concerned with the content of the dispute. He's concerned with the Christ-like attitude of how they come to that. Now, when I actually had a look at the words under this, I'm not entirely convinced there was a dispute. And I preface this by saying nobody else I read thought that. So I could well be wrong. But the urge to have the same mind. Paul doesn't say, get over your fighting. He doesn't mention that. He says, have the same mind. He's been saying this all along to the whole community in a general way. So maybe he's now specifically addressing two key leaders to say, you need to model this. Have a unified mind, have the mind of Christ. And then for the community, rather than to waiting to see if they fail or succeed or that at that, the community is called to help them to lead in that way. Philippians is the only letter that we have of Paul's where in the opening in chapter 1, he addresses not just the community generally, but specifically the elders and deacons. And we don't really know why that is, but perhaps because he's anticipating he's going to speak directly to the elders and deacons and have something to say to them about how they are to implement this thing he's talking about overall. He's held up in chapter 2 and 3 people, Epaphroditus, Paul and Timothy, as examples of how to follow. But none of those are currently in Philippi. Well, Epaphroditus will be in a minute when he brings this letter. So perhaps Paul is seeking to establish examples in their home community that they can look to and follow. It's just a thought. They might have been having a dispute as well. And then we get this piece that says, rejoice. Again, I say rejoice. If you're only listening to small bits today, What gives you any joy? The word is charete, to rejoice. And the root word char is to be favourably disposed. The same word comes charis, grace. Char. Kara is joy. Charis, grace. Karo is to rejoice. So therefore, fully it is to delight in God's grace. So I ask my question again, what gives you joy today? What causes you today to delight in God's grace? I have to acknowledge that it is tricky to speak on this passage to people because my life's all round pretty good. And I do not have the right to speak to anyone who is not in that place and say rejoice. And I'm aware that within the people sitting here today and within our wider community, especially within the people who listen to the tape at home because they can't get here, that there are many life circumstances that do not look like a place to rejoice. And I just want to acknowledge that I recognise that. That I recognise that I've got some front to stand here and talk about rejoicing to people whose lives are more difficult than mine. Paul wrote this letter and not me, thank goodness. And Paul was actually writing from prison where he was in a very difficult situation. So perhaps he did have a space where he could stand and talk about rejoicing in difficult times, perhaps. So if we read this as, be happy, then I have a real issue with this text. How many people have heard this talked about in that way? Is that part of your background? I don't think it's healthy to always be happy. I don't think it's healthy to squash down things like sadness or anger or disappointment. And there's been some really yucky Christian culture come out of saying that everyone needs to be smiling all the time. So I'll go back to where I said what I think rejoice means, delight in God's grace. If I read this as delight in God's gracious acceptance of you, again I say delight in God's love for you, then maybe I can come at it. And then also it makes a bit more sense of why you would say this coming straight after talking to the community about having the unified mind of Christ and possibly into a dispute. They've been reminded that they're part of God's life, and Paul then says, rejoice in that. And then in the following verse, and let everyone see how that manifests in you. It's really important that he doesn't just say rejoice, he says rejoice in the Lord. He does not say rejoice in your unemployment. He does not say rejoice in your parent dying. Rejoice in your child's disability. He does not say rejoice in your marriage breaking. He does not say rejoice in your body failing. He does not say rejoice in your mental unhealth. No, he says rejoice in the Lord. The Lord that we have had described as the one who humbled himself, let go of his godness, and came as a human being because of God's love for us. Whatever else is true for you, you are always in the Lord. And that is a cause for rejoicing. It's not necessarily a cause for jumping for joy, despite the lovely song. Because there's another Greek word for that, agaliao, and it's not here. That's often translated as exult. Perhaps rejoice is not about feeling good, but about acknowledging that there is good. I'll say that again. To rejoice does not mean to feel good. To rejoice means to acknowledge that there is good, and to do that at all times. No matter what your circumstances, and no matter what your feelings. Those feelings of sadness and anxiety and worry and fear and anger are real and true and part of you, but they are not your whole reality ever. Then he goes on and asks that they are public about this. Let your forbearance, is the word I like for this, compassion, level-headedness, good sense, let your approach to life be seen by all. It's another way of talking about how the community will be a witness to this mind of Christ. And why have joy? Why have this forbearance and compassion? Because the Lord is near. You are near to Jesus. You could be near. It's not clear if he means because Jesus is about to turn up any minute or because Jesus is near to you right now, but both senses are true. You are near to Jesus, therefore you can be magnanimous in your dealings with others. Therefore you can be joyful even in your attitude to life. So then he follows with, never worry about anything. Yeah, right. I'd like each of you, and particularly if you're listening to only small bits, be present to any anxiety you're carrying today. As Rani's encouraged us into our body, where is that anxiety you're carrying today? Allow it to be real and allow it to be close to God. I think that's what prayer means, is allowing that to be close to God. How is it possible to not be anxious ever? Because we naturally worry about things. It's an outworking of our love for people that we worry about them. Paul contrasts anxiety with prayer as the opposites. And perhaps anticipating that that's not going to be the easiest thing for people to hear, he expands a bit on the prayer side. Don't be anxious, but pray with gratitude, and God's peace will guard you. This comes out of our attitude of rejoicing, of acknowledging that there is good. If we live acknowledging that there is always good, then we are inspired to gratitude. So that when we come to God with our requests and our worries, when we are present and allow that anxiety to be close to God, we come in gratitude, primarily gratitude that we are welcome to come. Now, I've mostly heard this and thought it means if you pray, God will fix all the things you're worried about and then you won't have to worry anymore. I don't think that's true. Paul seems to see anxiety as a symptom of enduring your problems alone. But somehow, presenting your worries to God and even asking God to intervene, Paul anticipates that in doing this, your level of anxiety will reduce and will be replaced by a peace that passes all understanding. Does the peace pass all understanding because it's just straight out illogical? Perhaps. But perhaps it's about God's peace being able to divert around our rational minds, our rational arguments for why prayer can make no difference. God's peace can just navigate straight round that and pour into that place of our anxiety anyway. It bypasses our understanding, I prefer to think of that. It passes understanding, it bypasses. It comes up to our understanding and just goes round our rational thinking brain and it just gets into us. Now, I recognise this is the ultimate circular argument. I cannot convince you rationally that this is true because it's designed not to appeal to your rational mind. So, all I can say is that my own experience is that this is true. I am not a great prayer. I tend to pray at night when I can't sleep. And then I get into a guilty circle of, you're only talking to God because you know it'll put you to sleep. Because it does. I'm like, but it will work. When I do offer my anxieties to God, they almost always reduce. And I almost always end up wishing I hadn't been so stubborn about it, so rational about it, that I just allowed myself the peace of resting those worries into God a lot earlier. I think a lot about God, and it doesn't give me peace to think about God. But when I allow God to be near to my anxiety, near to my fear, near to my anger, and near to my joy and my love and my goodness, then I find that peace. I will not be able to convince you of this, and I don't think I should. I'm just telling you that in my life, this is a reality that's true. Paul is speaking to Philippi, which is an ex-military colony. So it's a very powerful image to portray God's peace as the guard of your hearts. Guarding the space, your hearts and minds. The peace will guard the space where you've been called to be united with Christ. This peace that can bypass the things you're putting in the way of it. This is contrasting God's peace with the Pax Romana implicitly, but by speaking to former soldiers quite explicitly. It's contrasting a peace by force with a peace by grace. God's peace is a peace by grace. Then we move on to, we're at verse 8 if you're following along, I know some people do, to a section encouraging us to logizesthai, a number of things. Logizesthai, the root word of logic, but also of discernment, to set your mind on whatever is true, honourable, upright, pure, good, praiseworthy, whatever we love and admire. This is a really Hellenic-style list of virtues. It's very similar to something out of Cicero. But where the Greek virtue lists are about ways to be good, Paul is putting it as ways to live inside the Philippian culture but keep a mind on Christ. How to live inside circumstances that cause pain and worry, but retain a perspective of joy and peace. He says, whatever is good around you, notice it, consider it, fill your mind with it. And then the following verse, and use Paul as a model, if you need to, of how that might work and what that might look like. Now, it could be straight up cause and effect. If you focus on good things, they will shape the direction that you go. But it could also be discerning. Look carefully at what's around you and notice what is good in it. I'm really good at noticing what's not good in everything. So this is a real challenge to me. Notice what is good. And not just in the Jesus-y bits. In everything, whatever, whatever is true, good, notable. If you're someone who likes a practical take-home, which I don't usually give you, you might like to go home and sit with your family and make a chart of this. Write these words with Christ in the centre, true, honourable, upright, pure, and brainstorm together what in your world is, where do you see these things? And have that somewhere you can see it for a while, to remind yourself to look for the good in those things. Notice how we're about halfway through the chapter and the whole chapter has been focused on saying yes. Even when addressing a possible interpersonal dispute, the only thing Paul has said no to is anxiety. Now, if I focus on, I won't be anxious, I won't be anxious, I won't be anxious, it's guaranteed to make me anxious. As Peter said, I get worried about the fact that I'm worried. And Paul's very helpfully given us something else to focus on. Don't focus on not being anxious. Focus on being united in Christ, on rejoicing, acknowledging good, being compassionate, on noticing the good around us, on remembering the example of the people we admire as models of Christ. So then we're on to a section about finances, which could be just a tag on, or it could be Paul's practical outworking of one example of how he thinks this might work. He's very careful to say, thank you to the Philippians for their generosity to him. They've sent him both Epaphroditus to be a companion and also money and stuff to help him in prison. He's very careful to say thank you without implicitly asking for more. It's very hard to do that. He's very careful to show that they are his partners, not his paymasters. He's undercutting social conventions of patronage, patron-client relationships. He's wanting to ensure there is no obligation between them. The wording is really unwieldy. It's, thank you, but I didn't really need it. But thank you, but I didn't really need it. And I think that's him trying to find words to be sure that they know he's grateful, he's acknowledged their care. He's acknowledged their care for the gospel, not just for him. But that his love for them does not depend on their gifts. Convention might have anticipated you would put the thanks at the start of a letter of thanks, but he's specifically bucking convention because convention would also create a binding relationship of obligation. The Philippians have been major financial backers over lots of years. There's been a break of some sort in that. Possibly the Philippians, Macedonia is known to be a poor area with other places where we know the church was poor. It's possibly they just flat out ran out of money for a while. It's possible that they didn't know where Paul was. We did not have the internet, and he possibly couldn't Facebook his status. But this break in the support has been rectified, and Paul's very careful to say, it wasn't your fault. I know you would have if you could have. And then there's an illustration of how the do not be anxious works in practice for Paul. He uses really stoic language of self-sufficiency and detachment from material conditions. I know how to live in plenty. I know how to live in poverty. I've found the way to do this. But he reconfigures it. Where the Stoics look at self-sufficiency, he is looking at Christ-sufficiency. He's not looking at detachment, he's looking at attachment to Christ. Saying, I'm okay in any situation because I am in Christ in every situation, rather than because I have the inner strength to rise above any situation. And he urges humility, which Stoics specifically rejected. I don't think it's coincidental that he's using Stoic language. I think he's talking to a community that knows that language and working at what is the good in that and how can we make it a Christian good. So although I've lacked many things, in fact, I've lacked nothing. Because being reconciled to God through the humble, life-death life of Jesus is all I really need. And then you hit verse 13, which one commentator called the Superman verse. I thought that was apt. Which is often translated as, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Sorry, that won't be on the tape. Troubling misreading of this leads to a real triumphalism and leads to doctrines about God's strength being what gets us forward. Philippians is all about Jesus' weakness and humility being what gets us forward. So I cannot see Paul chucking in a verse that changes that completely near the end. I can do all things focuses on the I can do all things. But Paul is focused on the Christ who strengthens. And in fact, the words underneath are, I am able, all things, in the empowering one. Or I have strength, all things, in the strengthening one. I am able, all things. Now, when that gets translated as, I am able to achieve all things, those words are not there, then it gets to, if I take my God pills, I can climb this very high mountain. Hurrah! But you could also translate it as, I am able to be in all situations. I am able to endure all things. And then you get more of a, well, if I find myself on a very high mountain, I know that I will be grounded in the God who gives me strength for that. For for limited listeners, I encourage you to ground yourself into Christ. Physically now, put both your feet on the floor and feel that you are rooted and grounded into the God who loves and welcomes you. And in that, wherever you go, God will be with you in that. I can endure all places because God is my endurance. I can rejoice in all circumstances because God is my joy. I can have peace in all situations because God is my source of peace. There's a final blessing follows that. There's a curious note of greeting from the members of Caesar's household. It's possible that Paul's been working while he's in prison at converting people in Caesar's household. It's possible that he got there and found there were believers. It's possible that, believers or not, people in Philippi, being ex-military, ex-civil servants, have familial and friendship links to the house of Caesar, and those people hearing a letter is going in a place where not many letters go, just ask Paul to say hello. So Philippians ends with joy and thanksgiving, much as it began. Paul's beloved friends in Philippi, and we as eavesdroppers on their conversation, have been encouraged and challenged to sink ourselves deep into the reality of God's gracious loving of us, to be united together in that grounding, and to live outwardly in ways that never let go of God's ever-present goodness. It from me, but you're welcome to ask questions.
The text mentions elders and deacons. Now they didn't have ordained ministers, so did the elders do the preaching? I'm just asked the function of the elders and the deacons.
We don't know. We don't know what they were or what they did, but we do know that women were among them, and women had been very core in this church in particular. They've been founding members and core amongst that.
Yeah. You talk about unity being a real theme of Philippians. Does, in your opinion, does Paul sort of make any distinction between types of unity? I mean, we can be unified in support of a wrong belief or a wrong way of living. Does Paul sort of talk about that?
He's very clear that unity is unity in the mind of Christ. And the chapter 2 about the self-emptying nature of Jesus who came and then God exalted him, so God recognised that is the way to be. That's the model, that's the mind of Christ, is that selfless, giving, loving way. So to be united in that, that's the measure of the unity, I would say. Yeah.